I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word Podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word Podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isgoff.
And this is Spy Talk.
I would never be one to turn down that kind of an offer. I mean, I could be a stupid person, say, no, we don't want a free, very expensive airplane.
The plane. people of a certain age may remember that TV show Fantasy Island. Mike, there are so many things wrong with this deal. Tell us about it.
Okay, let's start out. First of all, this is like a luxury $400 million double-decker plane that's going to be, you know, have all sorts of fancy conference rooms and beds and suites and whatever, bar, no doubt. But look, first of all, just the practicality, because the plane being offered by Qatar will have to be retrofitted to make it harden and protected from cyber attacks and jamming and nuclear strikes.
They're going to have to tear this. They're going to have to tear this plane down like a drag, you know, 57 Chevy. Right?
Yeah, I mean it's already
rebuild the whole thing.
Not only that, this is being described as a counterintelligence nightmare because every piece of that plane is going to have to be torn apart and inspected for electronic bugs so that nobody can eavesdrop on the president's communications. This alone could take years.
It's a flying nightmare.
Nightmare.
And, oh, by the way, let's not skip the main point, is that it's illegal. It's like in the Constitution.
Well,
the president cannot accept personal gifts like this. I mean, presidents pass, you know, they got $1,000 oil portrait from somebody. They had to put it away in the National Archives or someplace. You can't accept gifts as president, but we got a security nightmare here with this thing.
So absolutely.
It will cost jillions to retrofit this plane.
And just one other note, all this comes to light as the president makes his foray to the Middle East and meets with Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia. And look, he praises MBS to the hill, talks about what a great job he's doing. At one point, there's that riff about where he says, how do you sleep at night? And Trump is trying to make the point that MBS can't sleep at night because he's so busy planning the future for Saudi Arabia. What I was thinking is he can't sleep at night because he's haunted by the role he played in the murder, the brutal murder of Jamal Khashoggi, the Washington Post journalist, renowned Saudi journalist, who was wooed to that consulate embassy in Istanbul, and then on MBS's orders, the team comes in,
they cut him up,
and they cut him up
and hauled him out in bags.
Right, and so, we should say, look, I mean, you know, Biden said he was going to make MBS a pariah. Of course, he went over to Saudi Arabia and fist bumped to MBS, so he already set the stage. But Trump has taken it to a whole new level, as he always does.
Okay, back home, more junk coming out of the ODNI, Tulsi right. Gabbard shop. She fired the Venezuelan, the people who wrote the Venezuelan
report.
The
two top officials at the National Intelligence Council who were responsible for that memo that contradicted the Trump administration's position that the Venezuelan government of Maduro is somehow
sponsoring
an invasion by the Venezuelan gang Tren de Aragua.
A classic case of shooting the messenger.
Right. I mean, first, you know, Gabbard goes on the Megyn Kelly show and tries to describe this National Intelligence Council memo in the most dishonest way possible. She suggests that it actually supports the president's position. Then we got a copy of the memo and it's directly contradictory.
Wrong.
You know, look, can I just make one point on this? And we're going to discuss this with our guest, James Hines, the ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee. Look, Gabbard can speak eloquently about forever wars using the war in Iraq as the prime example of an involvement that we got into that we shouldn't have. And
I wouldn't
I think
call
a lot
it
of,
eloquent, but whatever.
Whatever it is. But she misses what was one of the major lessons of the Iraq war, which was the distortions and cherry picking of intelligence by the Bush White House to support their narrative that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and was working with Al Qaeda. None of which was supported by,
right.
none of which was true.
Right.
But
so here she's doing the same thing.
And she's doing exactly the same thing. Cherry picking that National Intelligence Council memo to suggest it says something that it clearly didn't. It was
also
unequivocal.
By the way, we now have news that she's going to move the president's daily brief team from CIA, you know, that den of deep state,
right?
You know, moving it over to the office of the director of national intelligence. More politicized.
We'll
see what happens. But
given Gabbard's track record so far in recounting the intelligence in a nonpartisan way, which is what they claim, I think there's a lot of reasons to be skeptical about giving her more control over what the president sees, because, you know, she's going to offer up exactly what the president wants to see and downplay or completely eliminate that which contradicts it.
Yeah, not to, you know, drive this into the inner core of Earth, but, you know, it bears repeating that the Kremlin thinks of Tulsi Gabbard and has said out loud, you know, that she's our friend because she parrots Russian lines. And as you know firsthand, because you went to Syria and interviewed the late,
not the late, the exiled leader in Moscow, Bashar al-Assad.
He'll be late soon. anyway, that she parroted the lines of the Syrian dictator on torture and poison gas and so on. And this is the head of national intelligence for us now. So this is very... This is not just bureaucratic stuff, you know, power grabs. This is serious.
Yeah. I mean, at this point, I think I've got like three candidates or four candidates, I should say. No, we'll keep it three because this is this is Spy Talk. We talk about national security. Three candidates for the most egregious of Trump's picks for his cabinet. Kash Patel at the FBI.
And his deputy.
And his deputy. Pete Hegseth at DOD and Tulsi Gabbard at DNI. I mean, I still think, you know, Patel may be the leader in that contest because he is most capable of doing the most damage. But God.
When he's around.
Yeah.
I mean, another report last week is that his daily briefings have gone to like, you know, from daily down to like two a week because he's not around or he arrives late. You know, we had reports he's spending half his time in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
This is not This is not what we're used to with the director of the FBI.
There is just a fire hose of mind-blowing stories we have to talk about, but it's enough of us.
I got a dent on the side of my head.
Okay. Enough of us gabbing. We've got a great guest. So let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to James Himes, Democrat from Connecticut, ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee.
Looking forward to it. Congressman Jim Himes, welcome back to Spy Talk. You've been a great friend of ours, and we really appreciate it because we know your time is really short. So very quickly, let's address the flying elephant in the room. The plane. I mean, beside it being, you know, illegal, according to the Constitution, from your point of view as a ranking member on the Intelligence Committee, there are intelligence issues involved in this transaction.
Yeah, no doubt. And thanks for having me back. I love it. The flying elephant. I hadn't thought of that, but that's a good way. Flying white elephant.
Feel free to use it.
So, yeah, I'm leaving the emolument stuff to the man who knows that stuff backwards and forwards, Jamie Raskin. But what I can opine on without any hesitation is, from a counterintelligence standpoint, from a strategic standpoint, terrible, terrible idea, right? I mean, Americans need to remember that this isn't just a, you know, Uber for the president, right? This is, as they'll remember from 9/11, when the country is in its like scariest moments, Air Force One is one of the key assets to protecting the president, right? So, I mean, this is, again, it's not just transportation. And I'll tell you a story to illustrate that. You may even be able to see it in the background there. I visited the Pakistani ISI, the Air Intelligence Service, a number of years ago. And they gave me a nice little blue and white vase, not very big, you know, just a little vase. And I thought it was kind of cool. So I wanted to keep it. And let's just say that vase spent probably 2 or 3 months in a laboratory somewhere, making sure that there weren't listening devices, that there weren't other dangers. And, you know, bottom line, obviously, for something that is absolutely, you know, at its core asset of the United States security establishment, you know, they'd have to pull every single screw, take that plane apart, rebuild all the software. From a security standpoint, taking this plane is look, this is no hit against the Qataris. The Qataris get beat up an awful lot. I think they actually serve a really important role in negotiations in the Middle East, and obviously they host one of our biggest air bases. So this is no hit on the Qataris. I mean, if this were the Swedes, we would have to take apart that plane, you know, nail by nail, screw by screw, and put it back together. So bad idea.
And this had been talked about for a while, that the Qataris were considering making this offer, which would be a message to foreign intelligence services to perhaps get to that plane whatever they can. Is there anything Congress can do here? Are any of your Republican colleagues share the concerns that you have? I should point out very quickly that Laura Loomer, the conspiracy nut, who seems to have enormous influence in this White House,
Rasputin of the Trump administration,
has come out against this as well, and included in her X posting the plane as a Trojan horse filled with Islamic militants. So some dissent in MAGAville about this deal.
You wrote a letter, didn't you, Congressman?
Yeah. I don't know what Laura Loomer's doing.
It's amazing that we actually quote her.
The intelligence community. I've watched her a little bit more, but that is not. That has not necessarily served to make me a smarter person. I saw that Senator Wicker had some concerns. You know, you see the sort of Susan Collins. I am anxious and have some strong concerns about this out of some of those members. Look, my bet is at the end of the day, this isn't, no pun intended, but this is not going to fly, right?
Once
the security people, really start thinking about it, it's not going to fly. You ask a much larger question, which is, oh my God, what is it going to take for the Republican majorities in the House and the Senate to realize that their job is to serve as a check on the president? And if you can't even do it for something this ridiculous, where the stakes are very, very low, the stakes are high, but you know, you'd like to imagine that the president wouldn't decide to politically end you because you made an argument against taking a foreign plane. But it's going to take it's going to, you know, what can I tell you? You know, the Congress remains a wholly owned subsidiary of Donald J. Trump, Inc. And while I see some cracks in the foundation, that's what it is.
Mm. Let's get to an issue that you are very much focused on. And this is the decision by the Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, to fire the two top officials at the National Intelligence Council who issued the report contradicting Trump administration claims that the Venezuelan government was sponsoring this criminal gang, Tren de Aragua, for an invasion into the United States. That report was clear and unequivocal. It totally contradicted what the president has said and what Gabbard herself had said just days before. The response,
in which they argue before the courts.
Yeah, a position they argue for. So now we get the news that Michael Collins, the acting chair of the Intelligence Council, and Maria Langan-Rieckhoff have both been dismissed. You've written a letter about this demanding an explanation. Tell us about your concerns.
Yeah. And look at it's not just the fact pattern that you laid out, right? And the piece that you left out is why do this, right? And the answer is that you know, in order to deport people without due process, which is something that just sends a shiver down every American spine, regardless where you are on the political spectrum, they're using the 1798 law, the Alien Enemies Act, which says that you can do this given one of two conditions. Number one, you're at war, which, of course, we are not. Or number two, in beautiful 18th century language, you know, if there is a predatory incursion. Which, of course, is understood to mean another state, you know, back in 1798, it would have been the Kingdom of France or whatever, who is, you know, sponsoring an incursion into your territory. It's not about illegal migration. But that's the argument they were making. And that's why I think Tulsi had to, on Twitter, make a very clear statement that she, because it said ODNI, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, agrees with the president that Venezuela is basically driving Tren de Aragua. Now, this put me in a terrible position because in early April, I read the classified report and I'm reading a contradiction to what the senior most national security officials, including the president, are saying and what they're arguing in front of the Supreme Court. So I was in a terrible position until, of course, that report was declassified. So, yes, and chapter two of this is that the two people who lead that organization are fired. So, yes, I'm very interested. Now, it's worth for our listeners saying, too, if you've accused somebody, if you're the director of national intelligence and you've accused somebody, as Tulsi did with respect to these two people, of politicizing intelligence, you're basically, you know, cutting the heart out of professional intelligence officers. I mean, that is the cardinal sin for an intelligence officer. So, you know, look,
we've been down this road before.
We could talk about the firing of Tim Hawk, which still remains a mystery because the Director of National Intelligence has elected not to respond to my now five letters that I have sent to her asking for the information that I need to do my constitutional oversight duty. But, you know, pretty soon you've got to draw the inference, absent any other facts, that those two were fired very simply for doing their job in a way that made the Director of National Intelligence look embarrassing. Because she was misstating what they said. Now, I don't want to jump to that conclusion. Maybe it'll turn out that these two did something wrong and they were worthy of firing. But until we see those facts, I don't know. I doubt it.
Let me ask you this, Congressman. How deep can you go with your own investigation or the committee's? Have you been able to summon witnesses to the committee for closed-door interrogations of these people? Have you been able to go out to the Director of National Intelligence offices and talk independently to analysts there? How far does your writ extend?
Well, you know, the awkward answer to that question is, as the ranking member, my writ does not extend terribly far. Now, if I don't get answers from the Director of National Intelligence now on five letters, I'm going to go to the chairman with whom I have a good relationship. And I'm going to say, Rick, this is basic oversight. This is very serious stuff. I need you to join me and I'll, you know, I'll explain. I need you to join me in getting to the bottom of this, because if the intelligence community believes that they can be fired for doing their job, two terrible things are going to happen. Number one, a lot of them are going to leave. We're already seeing that, right? And these are not easily replaceable people, right? These are people who have devoted a lifetime to studying the Chinese, to learning Farsi, to understanding satellite trajectories. They're going to leave. And number two, worse yet, they won't leave and they will accommodate a leadership core, which has clearly sent the signal that your career depends on saying what we want you to say. Those are two terrible outcomes.
I've made the point before that this is so reminiscent of the cherry picking of intelligence that got us into the war in Iraq, in which White House officials pretty much made it clear what they wanted the intelligence community to say. And then they put out releases that that deleted all the dissents from various elements of the intelligence community. You just said you've written five letters now to the DNI. In your letter yesterday, which you released, you said you've written four letters. So it sounds like you've written another one in the last 24 hours. And you also said two of them are not public. So can you tell us about the not non-public ones that you've written?
Can't tell you much about them. For obvious,
along the same lines, we assume.
Yeah, no, and I mean, I can tell you that they're not, you know, hiding yet another potential scandal. They're sort of run-of-the-mill things. But, you know, Michael, let me pick up on a point you just made, because you didn't say the last sentence around the compromising of the intelligence community around the weapons of mass destruction. You know, what was the harvest of that sowing of seeds? The harvest was a catastrophic war fought on false pretenses that resulted in thousands of American deaths and tens, if not hundreds of thousands, of Iraqi deaths, right? So, I mean, this is not a trifling thing. It may be inconvenient to have the intelligence community tell you things that you don't want to hear, but basic functionality requires that you have them be objective. I sort of can't imagine being an executive and telling all of my people to give me bad information. How is that a sustainable thing? And when you're talking about the presidency of the United States and the leadership of this country, it's not just your ego. It's not just what people think of you. It's young men and women in the military, you know, who
absolutely. Absolutely. It broke all the pottery in the Middle East, and we're still paying for it. Ended up, you know, Iran ended up with kind of a client state in Baghdad. I mean, the ramifications of acting on bad intelligence are humongous. I have to ask you, and I know this is probably a delicate area for you, but what you mentioned, you have a good relationship with Rick Crawford, the Republican chair of the committee. What does that mean? I mean, there's comedy, C-O-M-I-T-Y. But then there's comedy, which is that there's the Republicans have just laid down in front of the president and just do whatever he wants, no matter how obscene it may be. So can you expound on that? Do you think that, for example, the chairman would actually hold hearings or even behind closed doors hearings on the politicization of intelligence by Tulsi Gabbard?
So, yeah, first question first. You know, what that relationship means is, like all human relationships, it's founded in some personal affinity and trust. And sure, I would tell you that we have a good, trustful relationship on the committee right now.
That's great.
Now, I have not asked the question, and this is very deliberate, about can we have a hearing on what appears to be the politicization of the intelligence. I suspect I know the answer and what the answer would be. The nature of our relationship also is in giving each other a bunch of room. You know, I've been fairly aggressive in trying to do oversight, in particular of the DNI, because I think it's warranted.
Totally.
And I haven't raised hell over some things that, you know, I'm a little skeptical of that Rick is invested in. You know, we're getting a really hardcore review of, you know, the very preliminary conclusions on AHIs and COVID origins. And we spent and by the way, I want to be respectful of that, because, you know, in both cases, we don't actually know the final answer. So I don't necessarily object to going back and revisiting, but there is a little bit of a conspiracy theory element to that. So anyway, my point is just simply that we're giving each other a lot of room to do our jobs.
Well, yeah, as you said, and as Mike reinforced, you know, acting on bad intelligence, manufacturing bad intelligence, having malodorous aims in foreign policy has huge consequences, like the war in Iraq, the misbegotten invasion of Iraq. We've got these big issues with Russia and China. So, you know, Venezuela is nothing in a way, you know, in terms of the strategic position of the United States. But if this issue has to be addressed, the politicization of intelligence, or maybe you think it's a one-off with Venezuela. Let me ask you that question. Do you think this is a one-off with Venezuela for domestic political reasons, but in terms of core issues like Russia and China, that the DNI is on a more sound footing, less politicized footing?
I guess I don't think about it that way, Jeff. You know, to me, it's a very binary situation, right? You either have inculcated into you, as so many of our intelligence officers do, the notion that the politicization of intelligence is unacceptable, full stop, or you don't. It's not like, oh, well, it's okay in Venezuela, but it's not okay in China. That's not a way to operate. Who decides that, right?
And I agree.
You know, now what I could say and what I think is true is that I have no reason to believe that this president is particularly interested in intelligence, right? I mean, watching Donald Trump as I have now for some, you know, 11 years or so or whatever it's been, you know, this is not a guy who's particularly interested in getting a group of experts into the Oval Office.
I should point out that Gabbard is taking control over the PDB that goes directly to the president. So she's transferring the responsibility for that from the CIA analysts to her own office. And given her track record here, I would imagine that raises some issues of concern.
The saving grace is that Trump doesn't even like these briefings. Reportedly, only you know, suffers through a couple of them a week, as opposed to I guess they should rename it the president's weekly brief instead of the daily brief, because he's not interested in, and according to reports, he does most of the talking during a briefing.
So you asked about Venezuela, you asked about, you know, Russia and China. You know, yeah. A lot of the stuff that gets really scary really worries me. And it's sort of an intermediate thing, right? I mean, I could throw out dozens of examples, but let's imagine that a satellite picks up the fueling of one of the nuclear missiles in North Korea. And we don't really know. It's cloudy. So we don't really know. Is North Korea fueling a nuclear missile? Mm-hmm. Don't you want the very best people in the Oval Office trying to answer that question? Now, did those very best people decide, screw this, I'm going to the private sector to make twice the money I can because I'm not going to hang around with these yahoos? And then what do you want if you conclude that they're fueling a nuclear missile? And there's all sorts of scenarios, you know, somebody moving a bioweapon across the Sahel. I could go on and on. My point is pretty obvious, which is, you know, you want the very best people in the room giving you the very best information. Then what happens? Oh, my God, we think that North Korea is fueling a nuclear missile. Get me the Secretary of Defense to outline my kinetic options for me. That's Pete Hegseth, right? I mean, it's just.
Right.
Blows your mind.
I think I made my point, right?
To wrap up here, Congressman, I wanted to ask you about what's going on with the House Intelligence Committee. You mentioned two issues that they're doing oversight on. I imagine these are investigations by committee staff into AHI and COVID.
AHI, also known as Havana Syndrome.
Are these investigations you're cooperating with, and are there and what other matters is Crawford and the committee focused on the intelligence sphere?
Let me just spend 30 seconds on AHI. I'm cooperating on that. You know, we still don't have a good answer, and by good I mean a dispositive answer on what happened there. And there are literally hundreds of intelligence officers and diplomats and others who experienced something, who were who are really hurt by the fact that they don't know the answer to the question. So again, I want to be very careful that people don't in this era run with conspiracy theories or bad information, but that's a worthy enterprise that
for sure
Rick is devoting a lot of time and attention to.
What he wants to prove, by the way, is that somehow the intelligence community has covered up the
Biden's fault.
Yeah. They covered up the Russian role in zapping people all over the globe.
On the margin,
some mystery weapon that nobody's ever seen.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No, you're right. Jeff, you said it exactly right. On the margins of all of this stuff is what we see every day out of the Twitter feeds of the cabinet officers, which is, wasn't Biden terrible? You know, and that irritates me. You know, I know exactly who did the work on AHI, and it was the University of Pennsylvania and a lot of experts. So, but, you know, that's on the margins. The other, obviously, Mike, you asked the question. You know, there is a lot of, I would say, appropriate focus on rising China. And there's nothing new about that. But when I say that, what I mean is that probably our eye has shifted a little bit from Russia, Ukraine to China. And I'm not going to tell you that's inappropriate. You know, there's
not at all.
We're in the process of sort of destroying our own innovative capacity and, you know, sort of turning the Pentagon into a romper room. I think an extended focus on China makes sense.
How would you grade U.S. intelligence, the stuff that you're seeing, how are they doing? Do you think we have a good grip on what's going on in China from the immediate day-to-day stuff to strategic questions?
Yeah, I got to answer that question a little carefully. Put it this way, I've certainly seen no decline in the quality, even as we've seen some very talented people leave. You know, one doesn't really know for a little while whether the quality has declined. Let me say something that is less about what's happening right now than something that has always concerned me. We over rely on signals intelligence, and because it's because we're very, very good at it, right? I mean, the nerds up at NSA are just absolutely world beating at their job. And as a consequence, I've always felt that we under rely on human intelligence. I was just in London, by the way, and I said to a couple of my British counterparts, you know, they have a long tradition of human intelligence and especially have footprints in places like the Middle East, where I think they have better human intelligence than we do. And, you know, this stuff is hard, right? Especially when you're talking about hard targets like Beijing and Moscow. I mean, oh my God, try to run operations, you know, espionage operations in either of those capitals. Excruciatingly hard. But I think we got to do better. No question about it.
This has been a long time complaint, as you know, Congressman. I remember early on in the Afghan war. In fact, Michael Flynn, the now notorious Michael Flynn, he sort of made a mark by complaining that the command was ignoring human intelligence as opposed to the easy, as he called it, is really convenient and easy, just to find out what the enemy is saying over the radios or over their phones, you know. And the one thing that the signals intelligence can't give you is what the leader is planning next, what the enemy is planning next. And you need spies for that. In 10 seconds, how do you change that, Congressman?
Sorry, I'm still stuck on the notorious Michael Flynn as like the worst hip hop act ever. Look, the very quick answer to that is that you really need to invest in people, right? You need to find, if what you want to do is, you know, penetrate country X, you need to find the undergraduates who are studying in country X or studying here from country X. You need to,
and who may be minorities who you want to recruit under the so-called woke DEI program since the CIA is abolished.
Yeah. And, you know, we're in this sort of period of, I don't want to use the word hysteria because it's a genuine concern, but, you know, we're basically trying to kick, you know, an awful lot of Chinese students out of our universities. And there's a role for that, right? We don't want any espionage happening in our research labs, but we also do want them here for economic reasons. We also want them there because they could, in a very limited way, serve as, you know, targets for recruiting.
For sure.
Anyway.
I got one last question for you that's a political question. We had a One big news story this week is this new book by Jake Tapper and a colleague at Axios, Original Sin, basically laying out that a lot of top Democrats knew about President Biden's decline, physical and mental, and covered it up. And
were you part of the cover-up, Carter?
Well, I was going to ask the question a little more neutrally.
And when did you stop covering
please?
Up?
But your, I mean, this has become a serious issue for Democrats because it's looking like they concealed vital information from the voters for a long time for political reasons. Your take on this question?
Yeah, let me do what sounds like your classic D.C. CYA thing, which is just point out that I was actually one of the very first, if not the first member of the House of Representatives to say publicly that this guy should not run for re-election.
And that was after the debate.
It was after the debate. Right. And again, I saw it. And, you know, the debate concerned me. I had not had a lot of contact with the president, but let me say two things. Number one, I'm a little irritated by the, you know, I heard Scott Jennings on CNN say this was the biggest cover up in American history. Look, we all watched Joe Biden. We saw him give a superb State of the Union speech, including taking it to Marjorie Taylor Greene. I didn't spend a lot of time with the man, but look, I think like a lot of aging people, he had moments of great capability and moments that were not great capability. That is not okay for the president of the United States. That's thing one. Thing two, we as Democrats have got to get away from what feels to me like this, you know, imperium, you know, where we don't question our leader. Why weren't more people asking the question? Why was it verboten inside the White House to say this guy shouldn't run? That's this imperium concept is deeply, it's like wanting bad intelligence. It will make for bad results. We're now into politics. Why did Harris, when she was running for president, not accurately or not feel more confident in saying, look, I disagreed with the president on these two or three things? That became a cause celeb, right? I mean, it made her look like an idiot, right? And so why do we believe that we can't challenge the president? There's nothing American about that. There's nothing particularly functional about that.
Or challenge, it begs a question, or challenge the Democratic leadership in Congress.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
A little more reticent on that one.
Well, look, I
got asked a question. You think Chuck Schumer is a good leader for the Democrats right now?
After that debate, I reflected on the two or three times I had been in the room with the president, and I made the public statement that I did. I got my head blown off for it. But anyway,
Well,
institutionally, we should have been more willing to do that.
Your head is still clearly there, and we really appreciate having somebody who could come on and speak in a you know, fairly straight way, nonpartisan way about intelligence matters. So thank you, as always, Congressman Himes.
We appreciate your commitment.
Yes.
Really enjoyed being with you guys. Thanks a lot.
Well, Mike, that was interesting. The congressman is obviously committed, articulate, passionate about intelligence issues. What do you think?
Yeah. And like I said, I mean, he seems to me like a straight shooter. You know, he'll call Democrats out. You know, he spoke about his, you know, how he spoke out against Biden a little late, but he did.
But also Biden's revealed, decline, you know, yeah, is that he has so little power.
Of course, he can do nothing. As a ranking Democrat, he can't call witnesses. He can't, you know, take testimony. But I do think that the issues he's raising are really important. You know, obviously, the plane is the big story of the week. But the firing of these two officials at the National Intelligence Council after they release a report that contradicts administration positions, this is so reminiscent, as we talked before, about the run up to the Iraq War, and that you would think that would be
a
nonpartisan
issue
that we should learn. But anyway, it goes.
Another week of spy talk.
Yeah.
Insanity.
Yes.
So anyway, thanks for listening. I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
See you around. And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Thanks much for listening.
You can find lots more interesting conversations like this one in our archives, available at our home at the MSW Network or on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, mosey on over to our Spy Talk newsletter on Substack, where my colleagues and I offer fresh reporting and analyses from the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk, you'll find your way there. This week's Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to SpyTalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.